If you're looking for the skills and tools to succeed in real estate investing, you've come to the right place. This show is about breaking through barriers, breaking through limiting beliefs, and breaking through to the life that you want to live through the power of real estate investing. You're listening to the Breakthrough Real Estate Investing Podcast. And now, here are your hosts, Rob Bray and Quentin D'Souza.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. Glad to see you all here. Enjoy seeing your happy, shining faces today. And I need a little bit of that because it's been really gloomy here for the last like week or so, which is really surprising, Quentin. Normally we get a little bit of sun mixed with our rain. And now typically like this time of year is not particularly rainy, but we've just had a downpour. Seeing your face is just lifting my spirits already. So thanks for being here again today.
Hey, no problem, Rob. I hope you're doing well. I assumed you're talking about me, but really you're talking about all the people who are
all
listening.
Of the people. I can see their faces all right here. I'm imagining them all, just coming back for more of your knowledge and more of your wit and a little bit of Bobblehead Rob.
Bobblehead Rob is my favorite. Now that I have a Bobblehead Rob, it's on my desk and I get to, every time I think that somebody's not agreeing with me, I can always just use the bobblehead to agree with me.
What, like as a weapon?
No, more as a thought exercise.
No, but well, you can use it as a weapon if it goes a little too far.
Yeah,
you can always, yeah.
Absolutely. So I thought that today would be a good opportunity to really, share some of the things that's going on right now. We can talk a little bit more about what's in the news and also just some of the big items that real estate investors are thinking about and talking about. I actually had, just on a personal note, I tore my hamstring yesterday.
I think it was the day before because I just texted you.
That's right.
You're like, let me get home. I'm nursing myself home, and then I can, talk. So what happened? You didn't tell me.
I was wake surfing for the first time, and I was trying to get up on the board, and maybe being over 50 and trying wake surfing for the first time is not a good idea. Anyways, I felt the pop at the top of my leg, ended up going to the emergency in Bracebridge, and the doctor identified it as a tear of my hamstring. So I've got crutches. I was on some painkillers for a little while, and now 4 to 12 weeks recovery. So that's not good.
No, that's not good. Well, hey, at least it happened now and not before your trip. That would have been a bummer.
Yeah, that would have really been bad before Nepal. So that it's definitely, it's okay. I'll recover and then I'll just make sure not to do stupid
things. You
want to
hear something funny? Like, man, I hate doing stuff like this. I don't want to talk about how old and injury prone we both are, but what the funniest thing is that I hurt myself really bad on one of those, on that same thing too, like perpetual wave wakeboarding thing, right?
Right. Oh, no way. I was behind a boat. I was behind a boat.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
I was in Mexico. Holding on to a cord. And
I gotcha.
Right, yeah.
You're doing the real one.
Yeah.
I was just doing the phony one. But either way, no, I was on that perpetual wave, right? I had done okay on it, a few minutes. And I went back up again and went to jump on. And just as I jumped on, my shoulder popped. And it was ruined for like over a year. Yes. It's
hopefully my recovery is not going to be as bad as yours is.
I can still feel it, actually.
Well. Well, the Bank of Canada cut the rate for the first time in a couple of years at the beginning or this last in June for the rate cut. Mm-hmm. So it was 0.25%. And there's a lot of speculation now on a couple of different things. Are we going to have a rate cut in July? How many more rate cuts will we have this year? Does it make sense to go variable or fixed? with this type of raid environment. So I'm kind of curious, and maybe we can have a little bet here.
Okay.
So, and I don't know what we're gonna bet, except I want to maybe think of, how about burpees? How are you at burpees? Have you done
I'm good at
burpees
burpees.
before?
I'm fine with burpees.
How many burpees can you do
As
usually?
many as you need me to do, man.
Okay, all right. So let's do a bet for 100 burpees.
What's the, okay. Okay, go on.
All right. So now we got some time on this. So we've got, first of all, we could bet on the July rate cut. So right
Right.
now it's about 58% likelihood of another
Yeah.
0.25% rate cut in
Okay.
July, depending on what we see with, US stats kind of coming in, and can actually the Canadian inflation numbers as well. So what's your guess
Oh, I get to guess
on,
first?
yeah, you can guess first.
Yeah, I say for sure they're it's gonna like drop again.
By what amount?
Oh, we gotta guess amounts. Okay. Quarter point, I guess.
Okay, so you're gonna do a quarter point. Oh man.
Is that yours? Was that
Yeah, that would
yours?
have been my guess. So I guess we're, I don't know. We'll see how that works. Okay, what about by the end of the year? So there's been already 1/4 point drop, and you're guessing another one in July.
Right,
How many
right.
more are you guessing by the end of the year?
Well, last time, like it wasn't too long ago, I think it was January when we had Dion on, and he was talking about them not wanting this to be like a feeding frenzy where everyone got crazy again. So that being said, I think probably at least one more, but I would hope not any more than that, because I feel like things like when stuff like that happens and we get like four in 1 year, then it's just going to be a repeat of everything that just happened and people going out and buying stuff that they can't afford and getting in over
Okay.
their heads again. So I'll guess one more then.
Okay, so you're guessing 0.75 by
No.
the end of the year, like in total.
0.5.
So another t okay. So two more 0.25 cuts. I'm gonna go with three more 0.25 cuts,
Yeah. That's
right?
probably likely. See, I'm just betting
So
on what I went with what I wanted and not what I actually thought would happen.
okay, no, that's fine. So I'm gonna say that, and I do think that even with that amount of cuts, interest rates are still, I think it's gonna take us 2 or 3 years to get back to where the market was before, and I still don't think that we're gonna ever see those rates down as far as they were before.
I really don't think they ever should be. Like, my opinion is just that, I believe that there should be a reasonable range. I don't know, 2.5 to 5.5%,
Right.
I think is like a reasonable rate range. I know I'm being unrealistic, but in a perfect world, it would fluctuate between there, right?
I think that we're going to see rates probably down from where they are now by about 2 or 3%. Now, we're just guessing here. Please don't make your financial decisions on our guesses,
As people
but.
usually do. I know that's why most people tune in.
But the other thing too is, like, does it make sense to be in a variable rate product or a fixed rate product? And if you're looking for security in the short term, I would probably look at, if I was like going to sell a property in the next year or two, I might just go into a fixed rate product. But if I'm going to hold on to a rental for another 5 years, I might actually just stick with a variable rate product and ride it down, because over time that variable rate product is probably going to be in a better position than the fixed rate product. Now, you should do your own due diligence, and oftentimes it's a good idea. You could talk to a mortgage broker or a mobile mortgage specialist from your bank to try to get some numbers on your particular situation. But for me, I've got dozens of mortgages, and so I'm always looking at those numbers, and there's a book that I read quite a while ago. Milo, I forget his last name. He's a, I believe he's a professor at UFT or York, and he studied interest rates. And over time, variable rates do well or better, but in certain situations, like we've had in the last 2 years, fixed rates would have been better.
Right. And I was just going to say to you, your opinion there on selecting the variable rate mortgage, probably that's one of the first times you would have said that over the last couple of
2 years,
years.
yeah. Just because interest rates were moving in the opposite direction. So it's just something that I think people should consider when they're looking at interest rates. And you know what? I still think once we had that quarter point cut, I saw a lot of listings come on the market. Because I'm always looking at that. People who are probably holding back, listing their property in the last, year or year and a half. And I don't know how many of those people decided to just list their market over the last couple of weeks. But since that first cut, I've noticed a large amount of properties and a lot more properties sitting on the market. So there's just not as many buyers who've come into the market as
That's
there are
interesting.
listings that have been coming on.
The listings might have been spurred by that capital gains announcement, though, and
Yep.
the buyers are going to follow in the wave probably very shortly.
Yeah, I just haven't seen the like sales go up anywhere near the number that would be required to be able to take advantage of that capital gains.
That's good for
So
buyers.
it
Get
is.
out
It's
there
a
and buy. If you're in a
it's
position, call me up. We'll hook
yeah.
you up with a good investment property in Oshawa or Peterborough.
Yeah, it is. It's a buyer's market right now. Now, like I'm not a realtor. I focus on this for myself and my portfolio. But like if I was looking for a smaller investment property, I would definitely be, this is a good opportunity to try to take advantage of that just because of the number of listings that have come on the market. Also, the condo inventory levels in Toronto have increased significantly. I believe that they had the most completions of condos since 2014 in the last 6 months. So that's huge. And all those condos that are completed, people are taking possession of these condos and their value is lower than their purchase price in some cases. And that's going to be a bit of an issue. The other kind of issue is that, okay, so let's say you decide to hold on to these condos. Well, let's say, your plan was to assign it and now you're not going to assign it, right? Try to sell it before you close on it. And you couldn't assign it because you were going to assign it and lose your deposit or maybe a lot more than that. Now you have, I don't know, 80 units come on the market as a rental, and they're all coming on at the same time. What happens in that building, right, for rents? Well, they may be renting it at 2600 when they started, but now 80 come on the market at the same time. Somebody in a free market is going to like, okay, well, let's do 2400 or let's do 2300. And that's going to bring down the prices of the other units, from a rental perspective. And I've been looking at the numbers of some of these condos, and they're not even like they're so cash flow negative that their mortgage pay down isn't even covering their losses each month.
If you were going to
So
guess, what would you say that the percentage of owners versus like investors that are using it for as a rental?
right. I think it depends on the projects, but a majority of the I would think that's a
Like
good
of the new
question.
ones in the last 6 months that have come up.
How many are going to be held on as like somebody who's owning it versus renting it? I don't know those numbers. I wish I
It'd be
it's
interesting
not
to find
something.
out, right? Because that would have a lot to do with the rental rates as well, Because my guess would be that probably the majority of them are people buying them as investments.
I would think
Or
so as well.
at least they started out that way. And if they were able to assign them, most likely they're assigned to somebody who's going to live in it.
Yeah. And I think that's just going to change, because of the type of environment that we're in right now. With higher interest rates, a lot of these projects aren't going to work going forward. And a lot of what the Ontario and I would say British Columbian government has focused on is these condos as a way to provide, additional housing rental stock to their populations that have been coming in. And I think that that's going to be a challenge going forward, because as if interest rates are going to settle in higher, and let's say they settle in, even if it's 2% less than it is today, they settle in higher at that amount, you're going to have a tough time ever cash flowing at all on condos. And if you don't have the let's say the appreciation isn't there in the same way as it has been in the past, it's going to be a tough time for the number of units that are going to come into the rental market. I think not right now, because we have a lot more completions, but what I'm thinking about is what happens 2 years from now, right? Where, or 3 years from now, where you have people who, are thinking about purchasing and investing, and there are not the sales that are happening for these condos anymore in and now I don't know Vancouver, but definitely not in the Toronto market. And so you're not getting the sales numbers and the same number of people who are buying. You're not going to have those units available to be rented out either. There is going to be a reckoning that's happening, and I see multiple issues. We don't have the amount of detached houses that have been, or like we have the lowest level in decades of the number of construction of new detached rental houses or properties in general that you're going to sell. We're just not constructing them. Those are the lowest levels, and you see 2 or 3 years from now, it's going to be there is a reckoning that's going to be happening. And on top of that, you have municipalities who are starting to endorse plans that are duplicating what's already being done provincially. So they're implementing fines. They're implementing different processes to prevent rent evictions in their municipality. So, for example, in Hamilton, at the beginning of January 2025, if you are doing what would be considered a rent eviction, taking do you'll have to place a tenant for a year. There's fines. There's the additional components of making sure that you have permits in place. These are things that are already done at the provincial level. So the Provincial Residential Tenancies Act already does all these things. And now you have municipalities duplicating the same rules and making it more difficult for individual investors
Right.
to be able
And
to
I
do
think that the reason
work.
for that too is because the enforcement is easier if it's on the municipal level, right? Like it's much easier for them to send somebody in there to take care of it if it's on the municipal level. I can sort of see why they're doing that, but again, like it's such an overreach in my opinion, like on all of that. Oh, see that? Look at that
Yeah.
little bubble, thumbs up.
Well, I
Anyway.
mean, I agree. It is a thumbs up, because but it's also like duplicating red tape. Right. So
Yeah.
you're duplicating the same red tape that's at a provincial level, at a municipal level, and you're just making it harder for people. So what will end up happening is the people that can afford to be able to deal with all of this red tape are going to be bigger companies. So you'll have REITs, you're going to have, LPs, you'll have bigger companies that can deal with this. Because a smaller landlord, they're just going to go, I can't deal with this anymore. I'm just going to sell what I have. And people don't understand that 75% of the rental stock in Ontario is owned by smaller landlords. You're going to have a lot more people leave the with all these duplications, and you're not going to have the rental stock in your towns and cities.
Well,
You
now on
won't.
the other side of this, let me play advocate for a minute here. On the other side of this, a lot of these smaller landlords, have their head in the sand when it comes to all of these regulations. So what I've found is in situations like that, unless, like right now I'm dealing with a very, very difficult tenant trying to get them out so that we can do a few things and it's proving to be next to impossible, right? But I have dealt with very like quite a few tenants who are more than happy to talk and figure something out to in order for them to carry on, like move somewhere else, right? And so when you don't get yourself boggled down with all these restrictions of what they say you have to do, and the simple matter is all you do is go to your tenant and try to work something out with them. A lot of times that can work. So, where I do understand that people who spend all of their time preparing for the worst case scenario and reading all this stuff and those are probably the people that you're right are going to be like, you know what? I'm out. I can't handle this. Like if I gotta go and follow all of these things and then I gotta do it twice on municipal and provincial levels, I can't do it. But those are quite possibly, Quinn, those are the same people that are like, well, I can't deal with a toilet issue or any other kind of tenant issues as well.
Yeah,
So,
that's
like in
quite
my
possible.
opinion, I think that these are things that, yeah, when you drill down and you look at all of the regulations that we have, then it's such an overreach, like I said before, but if you just deal with people on a human level, oftentimes you can figure things like this out,
Yeah.
between yourselves.
Yeah, I think that that's the case for sure. I just feel like the more and more that we have added all of these regulations and red tape, the less and less there are people willing to deal with them.
Yeah, and you
And
and I are here to help them navigate it, though, the ones that
absolutely,
want to.
that's why I've written the books that I've written to help people navigate the red tape, the property management toolbox, filling vacancy toolbox. That's all about navigating, the Residential Tenancies Act in Ontario specifically. But it's also, I think, you're right. There are a lot of not really professional landlords, and they're not really interested in learning about it. But those are the people that should be hiring a property management company, right? And not necessarily, doing the management themselves. And that's okay. That's the I think you that's a good way of being able to grow as well. But because they can guide them into what you can and can't do. But I just keep the way that I see it is that there's going to be less and less. And then on top of on top of that, you have the capital gains changes at the federal level. So they say that they want people to be investing in more rental properties and more housing and all of that. And then they tax them more because of it. You can't have both. You can't have both. You can't, oh yes, we're gonna want more housing, but we're gonna tax you even more if you build it. Because if you're successful, we want more of the tax money. I'm sorry, it doesn't work that way. When you start to to tax people at a higher rate, people will take their money and they'll move it to a place where they can earn a higher return with less because of less
Of
taxes
course.
and
Yeah.
less hassle. People will do
And
that.
speaking of the other day, I went to Luke Y. I saw a post by Luke Wyrot talking about the development charges in different cities across Canada. And that it's just staggering, isn't it? To see the difference in what there is. Like, I don't even understand why anyone would, like, let's just vacate Toronto altogether. You know, we'll just take up, yeah. Does that sound good? I don't really like going there anyway, really.
The costs are extreme. People don't understand how much a cost of your house comes in your condo or your semi-d whatever your housing option is, comes from the development costs and charges and assessments that are related to the municipality that you are building in. So, and nobody seems to understand that those are all paid by the home buyer in the end. They are not paid by the developer. The developer does not pay them. The person who is the end buyer is the one who ends up paying it. So every homeowner in the municipality should be looking at their development charges and seeing how much is going into it, because municipalities are really messing up the development in their towns and cities, because a majority of the costs, sometimes higher than mortgage costs, higher than construction costs, can be development charges in certain municipalities. And that is really should be unacceptable. So, but if the person who's buying the house, that who's ends up paying it. And as people, as I think municipalities stop having development happen or have less development happen, they are not going to get that tax base anymore. And they're going to have to push the cost of the taxes that they used to collect back on all the existing homeowners. So that's going to be an interesting change when we start to see property taxes go up at a much higher level. That's where we're going to see some really interesting, I think, pushback from the existing homeowners, because a new homeowner doesn't necessarily have the political clout, but when the cost to build, like, people aren't building detached homes because it costs too much. It doesn't make sense to do it. You have to build higher density in a smaller footprint. So maybe a stacked townhouse would be where you'd have individual title, but it's maybe a condo type of environment. Because even freehold townhouses are a real challenge to make sense. So because of the development and assessment and all those charges. So it'll be interesting to see what happens as there are going to be less and less larger developments in communities, because it just doesn't make sense to be able to do, right? Like, when I look at some of the financing that's available, the only thing that I think that seems to make sense to me is if you're developing using MLI Select or CMHC financing. Because if you don't, your costs are going to be higher. And unless you have like a really big machine, construction machine, and I'm not talking about actual like processes and systems, right? You're still not making a lot of money. But if you're doing it on a larger basis, then there's a profit margin there. Like, if you're building a whole community of, let's say, 200 stacked townhouses in a given area, where the density is smaller, then I can see that you could make some profit, but it just
Some
doesn't make
still
sense.
like so even just going back to that post that I saw of the development costs. and where it's cheaper in Canada and the different prices that it costs for development based on a certain dollar amount of the projected development. Wouldn't you say that like where it was profitable for bigger companies that were like bigger developing companies in Toronto or whatever to build in Toronto, now it makes more sense for them to go somewhere else? And do
Yeah.
you think that that's something that's happening?
Well, I think what we should really try to get Luke Weirid on here and see if we can get him to chat more about that.
Actually, let's do that.
I think but from a development perspective, actually, if you look a little bit more on, how things have changed, like some of the development costs for smaller density projects have been like so some of that missing middle, like Toronto and a lot of other municipalities have allowed, 3 units, sometimes up to 5 units on a detached lot, and then eliminated, some of the development fees that are charged. So it's kind of like, taking 1 unit and converting it, or one detached house and converted it into a triplex or a fourplex, or a fourplex plus a garden suite. So you have 5 units on a lot. So that's something that's interesting. And but the challenge that I see with that is that if you were to tear it down and build new, most people still, the cost of building new and all the costs going into it, I still don't see that the numbers work. I still can't right now, with construction costs and values where they are, I still don't see the numbers working. Now, if you're going to live in one of those units and rent out the other four, there may be different reasons why that would work or not work.
To
But
me, when I look at it, I almost can't. Like I think it'd be very hard to justify even just the cost for adding a garden suite.
I've
Like
looked at some
just.
of those numbers. It doesn't make like to me. Now, this is just my opinion. Please do your own due diligence, because but I when I've heard some of the numbers that where people have added garden suites, like, you add 1 unit, you're getting maybe, let's say, $2,700 in rent for a new garden suite in, let's say, Whitby, for example, and plus utilities. But your construction cost is, let's say, 500,000 to be able to build that garden suite. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me to be able to do that, because although you've added the value to the building, the numbers make it a little challenging. And I see that over and over again. Like the initial estimate to do the work was, 300,000, but then, you start working, and municipalities are notorious for this. They'll, okay, yes, you can do this. And then we get into the actual, and then they want, like, a swell on the property to keep the water, the runoff water away from the sewer system and into a different, a swell or something like
They
that.
come up with some brilliant ideas
Right.
that,
And it costs you another $50,000 to be able to do that, and because of the requirements that they have. And all of a sudden, the numbers don't make sense. And that's what I end up seeing again and again with some of these projects. Now, if you're a developer who's just coming in and has an assess like a additional dwelling unit, a garden suite that you add on, and you've done this, 100 times, then there may be some efficiencies and things that you can do to keep that cost down. And maybe because of that, it makes more sense. But the numbers that I've been seeing from what people are portraying online and people are being interviewed on, and the actuals are very different. And I think that's something that people need to be aware of. And I just thought, as an investor, to kind of share that, it makes sense. Be careful what people are promising and saying, because that's what their company is and that's what they do. And the reality of what it looks like in the end is different. So you got to understand it. What I suggest you do is talk to other people who have completed those garden suites. Always talk to the people who have done it before and get real numbers from them. That's what you want. What was the actual costs that you had? What are the actual rents that you're getting? Whenever you're trying to learn something new, it makes more sense to go with somebody who's actually done it before and can provide that information to you, because that's when you're going to get the real goods on what's happening, not the company that's selling you the development process, or a salesperson who's selling you the property. But find the people who have already done it before. It makes it so much easier, right? And then you can make a more educated decision.
Trying to mute me, pouring myself more water.
Did you see that article about the Ontario landlords who owe 144 million in misappropriated funds?
I saw it.
And
It's mind blowing. And there's a report attached to it, which I went through a little bit. And my wife and I were having a conversation just before I came on with you, and just like saying, imagine it. And a lot of so let's go back. Actually, let's preface this with what we're actually talking about. So there's a CBC article.
Yeah, so what's I'll give you some context here for this. And I don't not like I don't necessarily agree or disagree with the media interpretation of this, because I don't know all the real details of the people. But what I can say is this additional information that's coming to light doesn't look good for them. But basically, they've borrowed a lot of these funds in order to be over 100% leveraged on properties. So they've been using promissory notes and second mortgages and things like that to be able to buy these properties, usually a number of smaller, properties, develop them in some way, adding units, renovate them. And the idea would be to have that new additional value added to the building, and now refinancing it and being able to pay out the first mortgage, the second mortgage, and any promissory notes. Well, the amount of promissory notes that they borrowed is in excess of $140 million. That's huge. And promissory notes aren't registered on title or anywhere, and they're only as good as the paper that they're written on and the person that's writing them. So it's just something that, like, as a lender, that's something that's very risky.
Well, now I is it all promissory notes, or is it 144 total borrowed from investors, like in one way or another, whether they were brought on as part of the project, or sold promissory notes, I
So
believe.
I believe that so there's first mortgages, second mortgages, and unsecured promissory notes. So
Right.
those it's
And
it's
that
all
equals the 144 million.
right. And then there was also the mortgage brokerage that was involved with this. And I believe, and I don't know the number off the top of my head, so you're gonna have to look this up, but I believe it was over 80 million that came from one broker alone.
Oh, is that right?
And that broker, I believe, has claimed corporate bankruptcy and personal bankruptcy, and was involved in a number of other promissory notes with other investors as well. So,
Windrose Group, which shut
yeah.
down earlier this year, it says 1,300 loans.
Yeah, and again, there were a lot of people that were involved with these loans that have had lent millions of dollars across different projects. And again, it's the same situation.
But
So
at first, when the story comes out, especially since I've had two of these people on the show before, and they've like shared their business expertise with us, right? And you think that hopefully this is just a case of getting in over their heads, right?
right.
And so they were they were given a chance to actually come up with different ways of trying to get things under control, right? But now, when I look at this report, because like I said, there's a report attached to this article where it looks like they've used a lot of this money that they borrowed just for their own personal, for their own personal expenses, right? Yeah. Things like luxury home vacations. This one even says a $5,000 Miami strip club bill. So, you know, things like that. I just can't even imagine being responsible for my partner's money and even remotely thinking of using it that way.
Yeah, I mean, and I, like I said, I still don't know the details specifically, and I don't know exactly how the funds were used. People use funds interconnectedly within corporations and companies for different reasons.
Yeah.
But like that's just this part of it coming out does not show a real positive light, unfortunately. So,
well, another
just
thing
something
I
want to
mention
keep in
here
mind.
Too, Quentin, like I just, because my mind's blown, I'm in the report, and one of the things it says is that there was a repayment of well, not a repayment, but a payment of shareholder dividends, right? in the amount of almost, what is this, over $991,000. But then they break down where the money goes to, and it goes back into the corporations of these investors, into different corporations that they own. According to this report, I'm coming
right
directly from the report that's attached to the story.
Right.
It's a KSV Advisory Inc. report.
Right. So just to give everybody perspective, if you're doing a repayment of capital, they could have personally lent into the corporation those funds, and those are being paid back. And maybe they are paying themselves back first before they're paying back any of the other investors. So let's say like I'm investing in myself and my own corporation, and I have funds in my personal name, right? Let's say I had a line of credit or I sold a property in my personal name. I would lend those funds into my corporation, and then my corporation would use those funds for whatever it needed within those corporations. And if now I need to pay those funds back, personally, because I borrowed them personally, it has to come back from the corporation into the personal. So it's not always black and white, but it is definitely something that can be concerning, because, you know, I guess what you may try to do by doing that is avoid personal bankruptcy and just focus on business bankruptcy or corporate bankruptcy, right? So that could be a way of offsetting that. But, you know, it's been, you know, this is definitely an interesting case that's out there, and it's something that is concerning. And I guess the other thing is that, you know, where people have been, like what I've been seeing recently is now at a different level, and I'm just making our listeners aware of this, there's been a lot more people who've been creating funds. And there is a company out there that helps people to create funds in order to, and these would be like, not necessarily mortgage investment corporations, or so that would be like a MIC or, you know, that sort of a fund. But this would be, like your own personal fund that you would create. You know, it could cost you, like say $100,000 or $120,000 to create this fund. And then you would use that fund to promise people that they're going to give them a return of, let's say, 12% a year. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to borrow from you, and I'm going to give you 12% a year. But those funds aren't registered on properties. Those funds aren't registered anywhere. So what is the security of the fund? So the security of the fund may be that maybe some of those funds are registered with these investors, or are they just raising this capital for them to invest in their own projects, and then they are going to use the funds that they raise in order to pay the funds that they borrow. And that becomes a bit of a Ponzi scheme, right? That's the same issue that we have, the same over-leveraging that can happen, but it's becoming under the guise of a fund. So people feel like it's, they're more confident about it. But the thing is that about it, a lot of these funds, they can be used in any way, shape, or form by the investors who are running them. So it can be very much the same situation. Now, I'm not saying that all of these are bad. I'm just saying, and I want people to understand that these funds could be considered very similar to promissory notes, right? What are you secured against? How are these funds going to be, give you a return if something goes wrong with the person who is running these funds? It's the same thing. And I'm seeing more and more of these being created. And typically, when you have these funds, you can only approach what would be called accredited investors or friends and family. Okay. And friends and family are a very limited group of people. You have to really prove that they're friends and family. You can't just say, hey, like I met this guy at a party and now he's a friend and now he can invest in my fund. It's not how it works, right? But that's not how a lot of this is coming through. So keep in mind what we're saying here on this podcast when it comes to that. I'm not trying to dissuade people from investing. I just want you to know what some of your risks are when it comes to that, and
Well, I
what is
think you need
hap
to
what I'm.
understand what your loan is secured against.
That's right, and not everybody understands that. Same with a promissory note. Somebody with a promissory note is giving a personal guarantee, but when the person with the personal guarantee goes bankrupt, that paper is worth about the cost of the paper, because now they've got no assets and nothing to guarantee against it, right? And you don't know how many promissory notes that person has, right? Because it's not registered anywhere. So like these guys, the other person wouldn't know that there's 140 million in promissory notes out there, or whatever other number it is. They only know about their note. So it's a very and that would be the same as the a funds, which I'm seeing a lot more of nowadays. And so I think that there's going to be a problem with that coming up, right? Like there was a mortgage broker, a former mortgage broker that was shot
I saw that
recently.
too,
You see that?
yeah.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy?
Were they mortgage brokers or were they just had loans out to people, investment loans?
Well, I believe that they had a fraud that was going on in the past. It was like, I forget the name of the company, like One Capital 10 or 12 or something like that. And they were, I believe that they were brokers, and I don't know if there was a mortgage broker or a realtor as a component of it. And then they lost their license as a part of this. So they did lose their license, but they had, it was millions of dollars that they had taken from people, and they had been stuck in this court process, and people had been stuck in this court process for years. Well, one of the people who had lost their family savings, who was devastated by it,
1.28 million.
that person who had lost that 1.28 million went and shot them. I mean, I hate to laugh at it, but there's like no justice
But
for some
then
of
he
these
shot
people.
himself.
Then he shot himself. Yeah, horrible, right? And this happened like 4 or 5 years ago, something like that, back in 2018, so 6 years ago, that like, and it's taking so long for this to go through the court systems, that and the even when they're charged, and they haven't even been charged yet, and these and the effects of this, are driving people to take matters into their own hands because they don't feel like justice is being done, and it's quite a scary thing to see that's happened, and but this is what's happening, like if you're gonna.
And you know what's funny is like in the grand scheme of this incident that we're talking about here, it was a total of $17 million fraud scheme. You know, it's like it pales in comparison to this other one.
Yeah, the person, I forget his first name. Masai is his first or his last name. And I can't remember the name of the company, but it's just crazy that that you're hearing stuff like this. Triple shooting.
So when we go back to this other one though, just for a minute, I just think that, I think that with a little bit of conversation, you can tell, like, maybe not. These guys are pretty good at talking about what they were doing, right? And like, someone who's growing at that pace as, just a small investor, you might want to think about that. You know, there might be red flags just in that alone, because these guys had over 300 properties.
So we're talking about the fraud, the Ontario landlords who owe 144 million misappropriated funds, Ryan Maloney, Robbie Clark, Dylan Suter, and Aruba Butt were those named in that misappropriation. So I think that there's just these are things that investors need to talk about, and probably, we talk about a lot of the positives, which are good, but we also have to, understand the cons that are out there when we're investing, and what are the risks as well. So I think that's something that, it's good to bring our attention to. And let me just kind of end off talking about some things here that I was thinking about when it comes to wealth generation. Let's just go
Very smooth
positive for
transition here.
like,
Let's get into the lesson of the day, right? Well, the lesson of the day actually is, do your due diligence, do your own due diligence. Like if you're going to invest with people, then do your own due diligence. Like, maybe talk to other people that they have invested with, make sure that everything's going smoothly. Also find out what you're secured against, because that's huge. And then, just use your own senses, I guess,
Yeah,
to
I
determine
mean,
whether or not it's something for you.
get some other opinions. Make sure that the person has gone full cycle in a number of projects, has been around for like 2 decades or more. Like that's where you get to see the ups and the downs in the market. Talk to other investors who have invested in the project. Those really are the things that you want to think about. And real estate does offer people who are willing to be in it for a longer period of time, right? Like if you're thinking decades and not like 1 or 2 years, I think that there is wealth that gets generated from real estate. And I've been doing a lot of thinking about this over the last little while, because I've really focused a lot on financial wealth. That's something that I've been doing over the last probably 20 years has really focused on financial wealth since I started investing in real estate back in 2004. And really, I've done well on the financial wealth side of things because I have a good reputation. I've been doing this for a while and I'm consistent, right? I've got that financial wealth. But there are other types of wealth that I've started to think a lot more about, in particular the last year or two. And really, there's financial wealth, there's physical wealth. It's like, having a long health span and a long lifespan. That's what I would be considering physical wealth. And then there's another type of wealth that I've been thinking about is time wealth. Like, it's great to have financial wealth, but if it's sucking up, 20 hours a day and you're barely having any time to do anything else but focus on that financial wealth, then it becomes almost a trap. So that's the idea of having that time freedom is time wealth. The other types of wealth that I've seen out there, and I won't say that it's as much as I should. I don't have that same type of wealth. So I would say social wealth is one of those things. I don't think that I have like a large social status. I don't have a large following of people or anything like that. I just, have a core group of people around me that I like and that like me. But I think social wealth is something that's out there as well. I'm not talking
So, in other words,
necessarily.
too, I think it's important when you're talking about social wealth. It's like you can go to a party somewhere with a bunch of people who don't invest in real estate and try to talk to them, and you're not gonna, that social interaction is not, I mean, maybe it has other benefits, but if we're talking about, well, I suppose if you're talking about wealth in general, of social, see, I'm in the same boat as you. So I'm sitting there and I'm listening to you and I'm going, well, to me, that's not as important. Like, even if I much rather go and hang out with people that I don't necessarily consider friends, because the only time I see them is when you're going to a function where you're going to talk about things that are of interest to me, right? And they have those same interests. That is far more, that provides far more wealth socially to me than just going and talking to people about random stuff.
Yeah, it's almost like if you go to a party and everybody knows who you are, and you by walking in, by not necessarily, being financially wealthy or, physically endowed with something that makes you stand out, but like people just know who you are socially, and that gives you status, right? I would say that's probably not me necessarily.
Is that what you meant by that?
Yeah, that's like, and it could be like a community thing, like people know who you are from a social status perspective, like you. I tend to be in different groups. I have real estate people might consider me having status if I go to a party or a place in Durham, people would know me. But if I were in Kitchener, people wouldn't necessarily know me. But if I go into a hiking group, for example, in the Durham region, some
Right.
people would know me, but if I was to do something in another place, I don't have that type of social status, right? But so that's what I was thinking about. And the last kind of type of wealth that I was thinking about was like a spiritual wealth. So like some people are just more spiritual than other people. It could be like, I'm not necessarily saying like holy, like a priest or a nun or like a rabbi or whatever. I was thinking more like just from, you're just kind of happier with yourself and who you are, and you're kind of thinking about higher being or, your eternal future or whatever that looks like. So thinking about those like wealth in that way. So I guess I'm kind of trying to expand my definition of what wealth is. And and I'm kind of curious how our listeners consider wealth, what they think wealth is. Like, is it just financial wealth? Like, what are the types of wealth that they think about?
So go on to Facebook. You want to put the post out or what? Like, what are we, how
Yeah,
do we get the answers to that?
well, maybe we can get people to hop onto the YouTube channel and post some comments
Oh, okay.
on our
Yeah.
YouTube channel and let
Yeah.
them, I'd love to hear what they think that their types of what types of wealth that they have.
I'm going to butcher this, Quentin, but my wife was talking to me the other day about luxury and the idea of luxury. And to some people, that might be that they go out and they get into like a, I don't know, Maserati, right? But my wife is like, look, we get up, we walk down to the beach, we see all these like exotic animals, we have our time freedom. So you kind of mix that in with it, right? To be able to do these kind of things. And not a wealth, but more a luxury, right? And so I thought that was a great opinion.
It's interesting. Like one thing that I think about a little bit too, and I think this is kind of a nice place to bring it together, is that whenever it happens and I meet my maker, I meet God, and I want to be able to say that I became the person that God wanted me to become. Our maker wanted us to become. I'm going to be that person. I'm going to give it everything that I had to be the person that I could become. And I did that. And I think that means giving it all in all the different areas, not just one particular area. And so that's something that I think about as well. So,
Well, I'm going to go there since this has been such a different show. I'm not a person that ever really thought too much about spirituality, right? But the one thing that I've noticed over the past few years is that there's definitely evil.
Right.
And so when you consider that, you can consider that there's maybe another higher power as well fighting against it. And so that has brought me to where I am today, which I'm not exactly sure where that is, but I feel like it's definitely a better person than yesterday, and continue to try and be a better person every day.
Yeah, very cool. That's great. Yeah, I think that's a great place to end it as well. So thanks for doing this with me, Rob. Trying something a little different. Really do appreciate it. And what's a good place for people to connect with you?
That's a great question. Everyone should go over and see what we're up to at that hotel. So that's on YouTube, Hotel Project Costa Rica. Go over there and take a look. So you can reach at me through there. But also, if you just want to reach out to me on email, it's rob@mrbreakthrough.ca.
If you want to get out in touch with me, go to quintindesouza.com, or you can reach out to me on durhamrei.ca. It's a great place. Or on Instagram, QmanREI, where you can keep up to date with what I'm doing, traveling, and I like to talk to people on there as well.
All right, thanks everybody. We'll see you next time. Have a great day.
Have a great one. Make sure to like and subscribe and leave a review. We always appreciate that.
Yeah, see, we didn't get to that. I usually do that up front. Go over, rate and review us, go over to the website, all that stuff. Go over, do it as soon as you hit and stop right now. Go do it. All right, bye.